Hello and welcome to ROI, Relevant or Irrelevant, the radio show where events of history are examined through the discussion of books, journal articles, papers, and presentations. Then historians and history buffs ask the question, what is relevant or irrelevant in today's world? My name is Jay Swords. This is the 556th show of ROI. Our guest for today is Dr. Jeannie Williams, postdoctoral fellow in history at the University of Virginia. And we're going to be talking about her upcoming book, Oceans of Kinfolk, The Coastwise Traffic of Enslaved Persons to Antebellum New Orleans. Joining us for the second segment of the show will be our history buffs, Terry Toppler and Ed Broders. So to begin with, welcome to the show, Jeannie.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
We are very much excited to have you on. So the first segment's called Farouk Tanaran. We're just trying to give our listeners some background to today's subject. So can you start us off with a little bit of information about how the slave trade worked? From where to where, what to what, how much, because I think all of us have gone through an American history class where we've talked about the slave trade, but not necessarily in much detail. It tended to be something that was very generalized, and then we moved on to other things. So I'm hoping you can kind of fill us in a little.
Okay, sure, yeah. So I think most people are familiar with the transatlantic traffic of enslaved Africans to the Atlantic world. In the United States, the transatlantic traffic was outlawed in 1808. And after that, internal traffic developed that transported probably over a million enslaved persons from the Upper South to the Lower South in the 40 years or so before the Civil War. And I'm happy to talk about the various factors that went into that traffic, the historical factors that sort of made it so profitable to enslavers on either end. But because of the abolition of the transatlantic traffic in 1808, the federal government had an incentive to make sure that people aboard domestic ships were not illegally trafficked Africans. And so because of that, any enslaved persons who were transported by sea after 1808 were required to be listed on a ship manifest by name and physical description. And so for that reason, unlike the domestic slave trade that took place over land, the coastwise traffic, which took place along the eastern shoreline, or along the eastern coast, was systematically documented. And so in total, the largest portion of that traffic went to New Orleans, because New Orleans was the largest market for buying and selling human beings in the United States. And in total, about 63,000 people were trafficked to New Orleans by sea before the Civil War. And those individuals are the subject of the book.
All right. First of all, just as a historian, I am absolutely amazed that those records are still available to you. Things like that have a tendency to disappear over time or become so degraded that you can't figure out what's going on. So how did where was this stuff actually stored, in some courthouse or in some archive somewhere that you could get access to? And why haven't, if that's true, why haven't we heard about this sort of thing much before this?
Right, those are good questions. So you're right that a lot of records from slavery simply do not exist anymore. And this is especially true for Virginia, which, was really the epicenter of American slavery for a long time, because Richmond, the capital, was burned in the Civil War. And there are other stories about records being destroyed in Maryland and elsewhere. But these records were actually created by customs officials. And so for that reason, they were federal documents and have been stored in the National Archives. They're in the National Archives in Fort Worth. When I first encountered them, it was because I was just beginning my PhD at Johns Hopkins, and an emeritus faculty member knew I was interested in doing history that would be used to living people and to the biggest population possible. And these records seemed to him like they would be of interest to me. And he showed them to me because they had just been digitized. And so I actually had the great good fortune of not having to be in the archive for nearly as long as I would have had to be if they had not been digitized. The reason I think that, so I should be clear, other scholars have cited Manifest many times. I mean, many scholars have cited Manifest. However, they usually cite like one Manifest at a time, whereas I decided that I was going to look at every single Manifest of the coastwise traffic, starting with the traffic to New Orleans, which is several thousand documents. And I think that, if I'm honest, I think that the reason nobody did that before is because nobody else was there good enough to think that they could do it. when I started out, I focused on just the Baltimore to New Orleans traffic. And even that, I remember my graduate school advisor saying, that's really a little overly ambitious. Perhaps you should sample, meaning, not look at every record. And he was talking about just Baltimore to New Orleans. And of course, I didn't end up listening to him. And did in my first year of graduate school all of the Manifest from Baltimore to New Orleans, which included about 12,500 people, and then decided for my dissertation to examine the rest of the Manifest as well. That said, I am still working with these documents, still working on these documents, still building Oceans of Kinfolk, the database I built with the documents, and it's nearly a decade later. So I think the short answer is everybody else had more sense than I did.
Well, and all I have to say is huzzah to you.
Thank you.
That's amazing. I only have about a minute left for this segment, so I don't know if this is a fair question. But so when we think about legal documents, most of us think, when we're talking about individuals, we're thinking about documents that have first name, last name, age, all of those kinds of things. Are these documents that complete, or are they missing some of those, what we would think of as normal driver's license kind of information?
Yeah. So the records, to be clear, these records were tools of surveillance to control, right? So they both mandated enslaved people's mobility by mandating that they were being trafficked from one place to another, and also sort of circumscribe that mobility. And so because of that, the documents reflect the larger commoditization of enslaved people, implicit to slavery as a whole. So the point of these documents is by no means to humanize the people represented on them. That said, the documents differ in really important ways from other records from slavery. And the biggest example of that is that the vast majority of enslaved people trafficked from the Chesapeake, so Virginia, Maryland, were recorded on manifests by both first and last names. Whereas if you look at any other record in the Chesapeake or elsewhere, enslaved people are identified with last names far less often. And the reason for that, I figured out the reason for this largely by comparing. I also built a data set of 11,000 fugitive ads published in Maryland. And what I learned was that fugitive ads, because they are authored exclusively by enslavers and sometimes sheriffs, they refer to enslaved people how they wanted to, which most often was with diminutive names, things like Bill instead of William, for example, and without surnames. And you even see the fact that enslaved people did have surnames sort of hinted at in fugitive ads in cases when the enslaver will say something like, looking for my boy Bill, who calls himself William Stewart, right? Whereas in manifest, because they were filled out by customs officials, who did not know the enslaved person before them, enslaved people were asked their name, asked to self-identify themselves. And so what you see on manifest is not only far more last names than you see on other records, but also far more formal names. So you see the name William, for example, is more common in manifest than Bill, but Bill is more common in fugitive ads. So while the records are problematic in ways that virtually all records from slavery are, there are also some really valuable insights into the ways enslaved people articulated their own identities.
All right. Well, we have a lot more to talk about, so please stay tuned. This is ROI on KALA, St. Ambrose University, 106.1 FM.
In times of joy, sense of grief. Broadcasters come through, even when all else fails. Today, with more ways than ever to experience the moments that transform our lives, Americans still choose broadcast radio and television more than all other media combined. We are the local broadcasters of radio and television, reaching more people, touching more lives. Brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Hello and welcome back to ROI, Relevant or Irrelevant, the radio show where events of history are examined through the discussion of books, journal articles, papers, and presentations. Then historians and history buffs ask the question, what is relevant or irrelevant in today's world? My name is Jay Swords. This is the second segment of the show, referred to as the Kitchen Table. Our guest for today is Dr. Jeannie Williams, postdoctoral fellow in history at the University of Virginia, and we're talking about her forthcoming book, Oceans of Kinfolk, The Coastwide Traffic of Enslaved Persons to Antebellum New Orleans. Our history buffs for today are Terry Toppler and Ed Broders. Terry, start us off.
All right, thank you. Yeah, Jenny, you talked about what these manifests included and that they were actually often had first and last names of the enslaved. And so my question is, for those doing family history, you know, it's especially of African-American descent, and I think of the 10 million names project, you know, how that has been helpful. So will this database be ever merge with something even bigger like the 10 million names through American Ancestors, where people can, or just on its own, where genealogists can search, hoping to find something of their heritage?
Yeah, those are great questions. So I know the scholars at 10 million names, and we've had some great conversations about exactly what you're asking about. The good news is Oceans of Kinfolk. So I should acknowledge that it's a little confusing. My forthcoming book is called Oceans of Kinfolk, and the database I built of their history is also called Oceans of Kinfolk. So Oceans of Kinfolk, the database, is public. It's already online. The initial version was published in January of 2021, I believe, by the Slave Voyages Project, which is slavevoyages.org. And I served for a time as co-editor of that project as well. About this time last year, I decided to step back from Slave Voyages and move Oceans of Kinfolk to a new project, which I co-founded along with my colleague and friend Yola Dance. And as part of this moving process, I'm also revising one by one every transcription that I did, just for the reason that when I transcribed these documents or began transcribing them 10 years ago, I was not as good at reading the records as I am now. Mm-hmm. And so the newest and sort of most accurate version of Oceans of Kinfolk can be found at kinfolkology.org.
All right. Ed.
Yeah, Jenny, can you explain to us kind of the nuts and bolts of how these transactions took place? And I guess I'm crudely thinking of this. Is this like a car dealer where if somebody had slaves that they, I hate to say liquidate, but had slaves that they no longer found useful, would a slave trader come and make an offer and then act as a middleman between the original seller and the final purchaser? Or, and presumably the trader also would be the person to hire the ship and not necessarily the captain of the ship.
Right. So you raise a lot of important points. So I'll start with the question about the ships. So in the transatlantic traffic, people may know that the enslavers were also the ship captains in most cases. That was not true in the domestic traffic. So you're right, with the exception of one large firm, Franklin and Armfield in Alexandria, which owned their own ships, most traders who were active in the coastwise trade essentially bought space for their captives on merchant vessels. And just to answer the earlier part of your question, I'm going to back up a little bit and explain why this traffic was so profitable for enslavers. So in the colonial era, the largest cash crop of the Chesapeake was by far was tobacco. Tobacco was very labor intensive, and so it required, well, it didn't, you could profitably grow tobacco with as few as one or two workers, but essentially the more enslaved workers you had, the more money you would make. But the problem with tobacco was that it is it depletes the soil of its nutrients after a while. And so by the end of the colonial era, enslavers across the Chesapeake region were realizing that they couldn't grow tobacco anymore, or at least not exclusively. And so many, many enslavers switched to growing wheat or having mixed agriculture. And in general, wheat was less labor intensive and only required large workforces twice a year. And so, and keep in mind that the enslaved population of the Chesapeake was consistently growing after about 1720. And so it wasn't that enslavers were selling people they deemed no longer able of working, for example. It was that enslavers were selling people they deemed surplus. And I want to acknowledge how horrific it is to talk about people that way. And so at the same time that you have demand decreasing in the Upper South, demand is skyrocketing in the Lower South because of the rise of cotton generally, and also in Louisiana, the rise of sugar cultivation. And so what happened was, as I said, over a million people are trafficked from the Upper South to the Lower South. Now, a minority of those individuals were trafficked by migrant enslavers, so people who are moving from Virginia to, you know, Mississippi and forcing the people they enslaved to come with them. But far more commonly, people were trafficked by traders. So yes, that looked like enslavers in the Upper South selling people to professional human traffickers, and then the human traffickers would either transport the people by ship, which is what I focus on, or transport them in long forced marches over land. And then in the Lower South, they would then sell the people. In New Orleans, of course, was the coastwise traffic destination. And so the tricky thing in terms of genealogy for the manifest that I work with is that they actually, for most people, only record the trader who is trafficking the person, not the person from whom the trader got the enslaved person, or the enslaver to whom the trader sold them in Louisiana or elsewhere. So much of my work involves trying to connect those pieces.
Sure. I'm going to sort of change the focus a little bit for a moment, because unlike what my area of history is, which is ancient Near Eastern history or early medieval history, where you really don't have to be monstrously careful about how you manage the people that you're talking about, because you couldn't track through to somebody who's actually alive today. That's not true for the folks that you're talking about here. A number of these folks do have lineages that are existing in today. So how do you deal with, you talked about, you know, it was hard to not want to talk about the horrificness of this process. Mm-hmm. How did you deal with the idea that these, you know, some of these, the ancestors of these folks, or the descendants of these folks are still alive and for whom this may be fairly traumatic to get some of this?
Yes. So to be clear, my motivation in taking up this history in the first place largely stemmed from my understanding that the people I was going to study were family members. I come from a very close family. My kinship has always been sort of central to my life. That said, I think that my understanding of the ways in which kinship relates to this history has really shifted over time. So the first several years that I've been working on this topic, I was really fixated on demonstrating and proving and sort of forcing the people to understand how much violence was done to enslaved African-American families broadly through this history. And I think the reason for that is because that is one of the largest findings that I have produced from analyzing the data of this traffic. So one of the things I did was to systematically count For every person who was listed by last name, which was most people who were trafficked from the Chesapeake, I counted how many people shared their last name on that voyage. And then after that, I also counted how many of the individuals who did have a relative with them on the voyage were then sold with that relative in New Orleans or separated from them, sold to different people. And the results of this work, which, you know, you can imagine it was quite tedious, but by the end of it, the results were pretty devastating, which was that close to 90% of people trafficked in the coastwise trade were permanently separated from their families. And so for a long time, you can understand why I was pretty fixated on sort of proving this violence, because it was so shocking to me. That said, I think that's also related to the way much of my work has been focused on producing and analyzing data. But I mentioned that I decided to step down from a previous project and co-found a new project called Kinfolkology. And that decision was very much motivated by a realization that data or the records of slavery will only give you stories of trauma and violence. And that, in fact, I think is all we can really ask of them to do. But the more that you engage with living communities who are represented in those same sources, the more you hear about the human side of the history. And you learn that people were not just separated from family members, but they also survived. Many formed families in Louisiana. That there's a long tradition of remembrance of ancestors and of kin who were lost, or I should say taken, in slavery. And so for me, my work is really at the intersection of data and digital methods and what we call definitive engagement. And that actually, those are the two also founding initiatives of Kinfolkology as well.
Okay. Terry.
Yeah, Jenny, you mentioned that these documents were saved because they were federal documents and that they were at Fort Worth. And so my question has to do with this. Well, so these manifests documented specific historic injustices. Can we see coming from this some type of justice or reparations for the descendants?
Sure. That question makes me wonder if perhaps you've read what I wrote for the Kinfolkology website. That is precisely my hope. So, even before the Supreme Court decision came out, gosh, I'm forgetting if it was last summer, which ruled against affirmative action, we were kind of suspecting that that was where things were headed. And in fact, what the Supreme Court did was decide that the state no longer has a compelling enough interest in diversity to substantiate remedial programs like affirmative actions. And while that, you know, on its face is bad, and that is going to set back diversity in higher education for who knows how long, to me it also sort of represented an opportunity to be honest about why, whether they be reparations or affirmative action or any type of remedial program, why they are necessary in the first place. And if you look at the people who designed affirmative action, for example, they were very clear about why it was necessary. The reason it was necessary is because there's always been affirmative action, only it was for white people. And so affirmative action was very much designed to address historical wrongs. That said, you know, in order to get the court to uphold affirmative actions as constitutional, it became tied up with claims about the benefits of diversity. And so now my thinking is essentially that if the Supreme Court wants to require that any remedial programs, whether they be reparations or affirmative action or what have you, be narrowly tailored to address specific historical wrongs, then historians have an important task before them, which is to present evidence of these wrongs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's true that it's also infuriating because we know that the nature of slavery's archive is incomplete always. And so most enslaved ancestors, or I should say many, are not going to appear on historical documents, and that will make it very difficult to achieve justice on their behalf. But that said, there are a lot more records than I think historians really have accounted for. And I definitely view my work in the context of making these records accessible to legal scholars and advocates for reparations who can cite them for what they are, which is evidence of crimes against humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Ed, you're going to get the last question of the segment.
Okay. Was there such a thing as a slave trader going north and picking up freed blacks or escaped blacks and then creating a false manifesto and then taking them to New Orleans for sale? Or did those types of folks, those bounty hunters and such, did they just fly completely under the radar? And another and another question I have is, was there private treaty sales? In other words, you might go through a broker, but you don't go through the auction block?
Oh, yes. Okay. Sure. Those are good questions. So the short answer is yes. Traders went, you have the story of Solomon Northup, for example, who was famously kidnapped. Well, he lived in New York. He was a free black man who lived in New York, and he sort of lured to Washington, D.C., under the pretense of a gig as a musician, and then he was kidnapped by the traders Theophilus Freeman and James Birch, I believe, and trafficked to New Orleans. So we do know that professional kidnappers did go north. That said, I think that we've sort of overlooked the extent to which enslavers used perfectly legal means to kidnap free black people. And what I mean by that is that both Virginia and Maryland, and most likely other states that I need to check the laws for, not only permitted fugitives to be sold to traders, but actually required that the purchasers of fugitives from slavery be trafficked out of state. So essentially they required that they were purchased by human traffickers, right? And the thing about, and I should explain that what the people I'm referring to as fugitives from slavery are what other people sometimes call runaway slaves. But the thing about the system is that any free black person or any black person at all could be arrested and charged with being a fugitive slave. And, you know, as long as traders were willing to open their pocketbooks and say thank you that way, it was pretty easy to convince sheriffs, wardens, and other prison keepers that even legitimate documents, freedom papers, were in fact forged or didn't exist at all.
Sure.
And even if people could substantiate their claims to freedom, they also had to pay jail fees. And if you couldn't pay your jail fee, you could also be sold. I mean, well, black people could also be sold. And so what I see are tons of cases of people being sort of kidnapped, but legally through this system. And I don't mean to discount the important scholarship we've done on, you know, more literal interpretations of kidnapping, where people are, you know, literally taken off the streets and forced aboard ships and et cetera. Lately I'm doing a lot of work trying to uncover exactly how common this was, where people basically used the laws of punishment of fugitives in order to kidnap people.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap things up, so please stay tuned. This is ROI on KALA St. Ambrose University, 106.1 FM.
You're listening to Relevant or Irrelevant. This series is produced at St. Ambrose University's KALA Radio and has been honored by the Midwest Broadcast Journalists Association and the Iowa Broadcast News Association for excellence in public affairs journalism. You can hear this edition of ROI and many previous programs in this series by visiting Spotify, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, plus Apple Podcasts. ROI airs Friday nights at 9:30 p.m. on KALA HD2 and can also be heard at 106.1 FM in the metropolitan Quad City area. You can stream this show every Friday night at tunein.com. Search for KALA HD2.
This concludes our 556th show of ROI, Relevant or Irrelevant. Our producer and engineer is Dave Baker. Our program manager is Rick Sweet. And the theme song for our show is Kayla's Theme and was written and performed by Mark Zapp-Zapital. My name is Jay Swords. We would like to thank our guest, Dr. Jenny Williams, postdoctoral fellow in history at the University of Virginia. We have been talking about her forthcoming book, Oceans of Kinfolk, The Coastwise Traffic of Enslaved Persians to Antebellum New Orleans. The history buffs for today's show were Terry Toppler and Ed Broders. This is ROI, Relevant or Irrelevant, on KALA. Views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of St. Ambrose University or KALA. We would like to wish all of our listeners to experience the great Basutu proverb, Hotza Pulinala, peace, reign, and prosperity. And remember, historians are horrible fortune tellers. Good night.